Ruth's right eye. For a pawn, Eddie asked a lot of questions. When Marion had recovered sufficiently from her infection so that they could make love again, Eddie asked her about what sort of infection she'd had. It was a bladder infection, she told him. She was still more of a natural mother than she knew. She spared him the potentially upsetting news that the infection had been the result of his repeated sexual attentions. They had just finished making love in the position that Marion favored. She liked sitting on Eddie, riding him, Marion called it, because she enjoyed seeing his face. It was not only that Eddie's expressions haunted her pleasantly because of their ceaseless associations with Thomas and Timothy. It was also that Marion had begun the process of saying goodbye to the boy, who had affected her more intimately than she'd ever thought he would. She knew, of course, how strongly she had affected him. This worried her. But in looking at him, and in making love to him, especially in looking at him while making love to him, Marion imagined that she could see her sexual life, which had been so ardently, albeit briefly, rekindled, coming to an end. She had not told Eddie that before him she'd never had sex with anyone except Ted. Nor had she told Eddie that she'd had sex with Ted only once since her sons had died, and that one time, entirely at Ted's initiation, had been strictly for the purpose of getting her pregnant. She had not wanted to get pregnant, but she'd been too despondent to resist. And since Ruth was born, Marion had not been tempted to have sex at all. With Eddie, what had begun on Marion's part as a kindness toward a shy boy, in whom she saw so much of her sons, had blossomed into a relationship that had been deeply rewarding to her. But if Marion had been surprised by the excitement and gratification Eddie had provided, her enjoyment of the boy had nevertheless not persuaded her to alter her plans. She was leaving more than Ted and Ruth. In saying goodbye to Eddie O'Hare, she was also saying goodbye to a sexual life of any kind. Here she was, saying goodbye to sex when, for the first time at 39, she was finding sex pleasurable. If Marion and Eddie were the same height in the summer of 58, Marion was aware that she outweighed him. Eddie was excruciatingly thin. In the top position, bearing down on the boy, Marion felt that all her weight and strength were concentrated in her hips. With Eddie pinned beneath her, Marion sometimes felt that it was she who was penetrating him. Indeed, the motion of her hips was the only motion between them. Eddie wasn't strong enough to lift her weight off him. There was an instant when Marion not only felt as if she'd entered the boy's body, she was fairly certain she had paralyzed him. When she could tell by how he held his breath that he was about to come, she would drop her weight on his chest and, holding tight to his shoulders, roll him on top of her because she couldn't stand to see the look that transformed his face when he came. There was something too close to the anticipation of pain in it. Marion could hardly bear to hear him whimper, and he whimpered every time. It was the sound of a child crying out in a half-sleep before falling sound asleep again. Only this repeated split second in her entire relationship with Eddie ever caused Marion a half-moment of doubt. When the boy made this infantile sound, it made Marion feel guilty. Afterwards, Eddie lay on his side with his face against her breasts. Marion ran her fingers through the boy's hair. Even then, Marion could not stop herself from making a critical observation of Eddie's haircut. She made a mental note to tell the barber to take a little less off the back next time. Then she revised her mental note. The summer was running out. There would be no next time. That was when Eddie asked his second question of the night. "Tell me about the accident," he said. "I mean,
Do you know how it happened? Was it anybody's fault?
A second before, pulsing against his temple, he had felt her heart beating through her breast. But now it seemed to Eddie that Marion's heart had stopped. When he lifted his head to look at her face, she was already turning her back to him. This time there wasn't even the slightest shaking of her shoulders. Her spine was straight, her back rigid, her shoulders square. He came around the bed and knelt beside her and looked into her eyes, which were open but distant. Her lips, which when she slept were full and parted, were thin and closed.
"I'm sorry," Eddie whispered. "I'll never ask you again."
But Marion remained as she was, her face a mask, her body a stone.
"Mommy!"
Ruth called, but Marion didn't hear her. She didn't even blink. Eddie froze, waiting for the patter of the 4-year-old's feet across the bathroom floor. But the child was staying in her bed.
"Mommy!"
she cried more tentatively now. There was a hint of worry in her voice. Eddie crept out of bed, naked, and tiptoed to the bathroom. He wrapped a bath towel around his waist, a better choice than a lampshade. Then, as quietly as possible, Eddie began to retreat, in the direction of the hall.
"Eddie?"
the child asked. Her voice was a whisper.
"Yes,"
Eddie answered. He tightened the towel around himself and padded barefoot through the bathroom to the child's room. Eddie thought that the sight of Marion would have frightened Ruth more than the child was already frightened. That is, if the 4-year-old had seen her mother in Marion's newly acquired, seemingly catatonic state. Ruth was sitting up in bed, not moving, when Eddie walked into her room.
"Where's Mommy?"
the child asked him. "She's asleep," Eddie lied.
"Oh,"
the girl said. With a look, she indicated the towel knotted around Eddie's waist.
"Did you take a bath?"
"Yes," he lied again.
"Oh,"
Ruth said.
"But what did I dream about?"
"What did you dream about?" Eddie repeated stupidly.
I don't know. I didn't have your dream. What did you dream about?" "Tell me,"
the child demanded.
"But it's your dream," Eddie pointed out. "Oh,"
the 4-year-old said. "Would you like a drink of water?" Eddie asked.
"Okay,"
Ruth replied. She waited while he ran the water until it was cold and brought it to her in a cup. When she handed the cup back to him, she asked,
"Where are the feet?"
"In the photograph, where they always are," Eddie told her.
"But what happened to them?" Ruth asked.
"Nothing happened to them," Eddie assured her. "Do you want to see them?"
"Yes,"
the girl replied. She held out her arms, expecting to be carried, and he lifted her out of bed. Together they navigated the unlit hall. Both of them were aware of the infinite variety of expressions on the faces of the dead boys whose photographs were mercifully in semi-darkness. At the end of the guest wing, the light from Eddie's room shone as brightly as a beacon. Eddie carried Ruth into the bathroom, where, without speaking, they looked at the picture of Marion in the Hotel du Quai Voltaire. Then Ruth said,
"It was early in the morning. Mommy was just waking up. Thomas and Timothy had crawled under the covers. Daddy took the picture in France."
"In Paris, yes," Eddie said. Marion had told him that the hotel was located on the Seine. Their room had faced the Louvre. It had been Marion's first time in Paris, the boy's only time. Ruth pointed to the bigger of the bare feet.
"Thomas," she said.
Then she pointed to the smaller of the feet. She waited for Eddie to speak.
"Timothy," Eddie guessed. "Right," the 4-year-old said. "But what did you did to the feet?"
"Me?
Nothing,"
Eddie lied.
"It looked like paper, little pieces of paper," Ruth told him. Her eyes searched the bathroom. She made Eddie put her down so that she could peer into the wastebasket. But the maid had come to clean the room many times since Eddie had removed the scraps of notepaper. Finally, Ruth held out her arms to Eddie. Once more, he picked her up.
"I hope it doesn't happen again," the 4-year-old said.
"Maybe it never happened. Maybe it was a dream," Eddie told her.
"No,"
the child replied.
"I guess it's a mystery," Eddie said.
"No," Ruth told him. "It was paper. 2 pieces.
She kept scowling at the photograph, daring it to change. Years later, Eddie O'Hare would be unsurprised that, as a novelist, Ruth Cole was a realist. But there in the bathroom, Eddie went on holding the child in his arms. At last he asked the girl,
"Don't you want to go back to bed?"
"Yes," Ruth replied, "but bring the picture."
They went down the dark hall, which seemed darker now. The feeble nightlight from the master bathroom cast only the dimmest glow out the open door of Ruth's room. Eddie carried the child against his chest. He found her heavy to carry with one arm. In his other hand, he carried the photograph. He put Ruth back in her bed and leaned the picture of Marion in Paris against a chest of drawers. The photograph faced Ruth, but the child complained that the photo was too far away from her bed for her to see it properly. Eddie ended up propping the photograph against the footstool near the head of Ruth's bunk bed. Ruth was satisfied. The 4-year-old fell back to sleep. Before Eddie went back to his room, he took another look at Marion. Her eyes were closed, her lips were parted in her sleep, and her body had given up its terrifying rigidity. Only a sheet covered her hips, her upper body was bare. It was a warm night. Eddie, nevertheless, covered her breasts with the sheet. She looked a little less abandoned that way. Eddie was so tired that he lay down on his bed and fell asleep with the towel still wrapped around his waist. In the morning, he woke to the sound of Marion calling for him. She was screaming out his name, and he could hear Ruth crying hysterically. He ran down the hall, still in the towel, and found Marion and Ruth bent over a blood-stained sink in the bathroom. There was blood everywhere. It was on the child's pajamas, on her face, in her hair. The source was a single deep cut in Ruth's right index finger. The pad of the first joint of her finger had been slashed to the bone. The cut was perfectly straight and extremely thin. "She said it was glass," Marion told Eddie, "but there's no glass in the cut." "What glass, honey?" Marion asked Ruth. The picture," the child cried. In an effort to conceal the photograph under her bunk, Ruth must have banged the picture frame against a part of her bed or against the footstool. The glass covering the photo was shattered. The photograph itself was undamaged, although the mat was spotted with blood.
"What did I did?"
the 4-year-old kept asking. Eddie held her while her mother got dressed, then Marion held Ruth while Eddie dressed himself. Ruth had stopped crying and was now more concerned about the photograph than about her finger. They took the photo, still in the blood-spotted mat, out of the shattered frame. They brought the picture in the car with them because Ruth wanted the picture to come to the hospital. Marion tried to talk to Ruth about what stitches were and that there would probably be at least one shot. In truth, there would be 2, the procaine injection before the stitches and then a tetanus shot. Despite how deep it was, the cut was so clean and so thin that Marion was sure it wouldn't require more than 2 or 3 stitches or leave a visible scar.
"What's a scar?" the child asked. "Am I going to die?"
"No, you are not going to die, honey," her mother assured her. Then the conversation turned to the matter of fixing the photograph. When they were finished at the hospital, they would take the photo to a frame shop in Southampton and leave it to be reframed. Ruth began to cry again because she didn't want the picture to be left at the shop.
Eddie explained that there had to be a new mat, a new frame, and new glass.
"What's a mat?" the 4-year-old asked.
When Marion showed Ruth the blood-spotted mat, but not the photograph, Ruth wanted to know why the bloodstain wasn't red. The spot of blood had dried and turned brown.
"Will I turn brown?" Ruth asked. "Am I going to die?"
"No, you won't, honey. No, you're not," Marion kept telling her.
Of course, Ruth screamed at the needles and at the stitches. There were only two. The doctor marveled at the perfect straightness of the wound. The pad of the right index finger had been precisely bisected. It would have been next to impossible for a surgeon to have cut the exact middle of such a small finger so deliberately, even with a scalpel. After they dropped off the photograph at the frame shop, Ruth sat subdued in her mother's lap. Eddie drove back to Sagaponack, squinting into the morning sun. Marion lowered the sun visor on the passenger side, but Ruth was so short that the sunlight shone directly into her face, causing her to turn toward her mother. Suddenly, Marion began to stare into her daughter's eyes, into Ruth's right eye in particular.
"What's the matter?" Eddie asked. "Is there something in her eye?"
"It's nothing," Marion said.
The child curled against her mother, who shielded the sunlight from her daughter's face with her hand. Exhausted from all her crying, Ruth fell asleep before they reached Sagaponack.
"What did you see?" Eddie asked Marion, whose gaze was notably distant again.
It was not as distant as the night before when Eddie had asked her about the accident to her boys.
"Tell me," he said.
Marion pointed to her own right eye.
"You've seen this, haven't you?" she asked, turning her face toward him.
She meant the flaw in the iris of her right eye, that hexagon of yellow which Eddie had often admired. He had more than once remarked to her that he loved the tiny yellow speck in her eye, the way, in certain light or at unpredictable angles, it could turn her right eye from blue to green. Although Ruth's eyes were brown, what Marion had seen in the iris of Ruth's right eye was the exact same hexagonal shape of bright yellow. When the 4-year-old had blinked in the sunlight, the yellow hexagon had demonstrated its capacity to turn Ruth's right eye from brown to amber. Marion continued to hug her sleeping daughter to her breast. With one hand, she still shielded the 4-year-old's face from the sun. Eddie had never before seen Marion manifest such a degree of physical affection for Ruth.
"Your eye doesn't hurt you, does it?" he asked Marion. "And you can see with it. It doesn't affect your vision, does it? Besides, it's very distinguished," the 16-year-old said. "It's like a birthmark, only more mysterious."
"The poor child," Marion interrupted him. "I don't want her to be like me."
Dumping Mrs. Vaughan. For the next 5 or 6 days, before Ruth's stitches were removed, the child didn't go to the beach. The nuisance of keeping the cut dry made the nannies irritable. Eddie detected an increased sullenness in Ted and Marion's behavior toward each other. They had always avoided each other, but now they never spoke to each other or even looked at each other. When one wanted to complain about the other, the complaint was made to Eddie. For example, Ted held Marion responsible for Ruth's injury, although Eddie had repeatedly told him that it was he who had let Ruth have the photograph.
"That's not the point," Ted said. "The point is, you shouldn't have gone into her room in the first place. That's her mother's job."
"I told you Marion was asleep," Eddie lied.
"I doubt it," Ted told the boy. "I doubt that asleep accurately describes Marion's condition. I would guess that she was zonked."
Eddie wasn't sure what Ted meant. He said,
"She wasn't drunk, if that's what you mean."
"I didn't say she was drunk. She's never drunk," Ted told Eddie.
"I said she was zonked, wasn't she?"
Eddie didn't know what to say. He reported the problem to Marion.
"Did you tell him why?" she asked the boy. "Did you tell him what you asked me?"
Eddie was shocked.
"No, of course not," the 16-year-old said. tell him," Marion exclaimed. So Eddie told Ted what happened when he asked Marion about the accident.
"I guess I zonked her," Eddie explained. "I keep telling you, the whole thing is my fault."
"No, it's Marion's fault," Ted insisted.
"Oh, who cares whose fault it is?" Marion said to Eddie.
"I care," Eddie said. "I'm the one who let Ruth have the photograph in her room."
"This isn't about the photograph. Don't be silly," Marion told the 16-year-old. "This has nothing to do with you, Eddie."
It was a blow to the boy to realize that she was right. Eddie O'Hare was involved in what would be the most important relationship in his life. Yet what was happening between Ted and Marion had nothing to do with him. Meanwhile, Ruth asked every day about the unreturned photograph. Every day there was a phone call to the frame shop in Southampton, but the matting and framing of a single 8x10 photo was not a priority in the framer's busiest season of the year. Would the new mat have a spot of blood on it? Ruth wanted to know. No, it would not. Would the new frame and the new glass be exactly like the old frame and the old glass? Close enough. And every day and every night, Ruth would lead the nannies or her mother or father or Eddie through the gallery of photographs hanging in the Coles' house. If she touched that photo, could the glass cut her? If she dropped this one, was it also glass and would it break? Why did glass break anyway? And if glass could cut you, why would you want any glass in your house? In the midst of Ruth's repeated questions, the month of August passed the midpoint. It was markedly cooler at night. Even the carriage house was comfortable for sleeping. One night when Eddie and Marion were sleeping there, Marion forgot to tack the towel over the skylight. They were awakened early in the morning by a low-flying flock of geese. Marion said, "Going south already?" She didn't speak to Eddie or to Ruth for the rest of the day. Ted radically revised a sound like someone trying not to make a sound. For almost a week, he presented Eddie with a completely rewritten draft every morning. Eddie would retype the manuscript the same day. The next morning, Ted's rewrite would come back to him. No sooner was Eddie beginning to feel like an actual writer's assistant than the rewriting process stopped. Eddie wouldn't see a sound like someone trying not to make a sound again until it was published. Although it would be Ruth's favorite among her father's books, it would never be a favorite of Eddie's. He'd seen too many versions of it to appreciate the final draft. He would also feel a vague uneasiness about the illustrations, which he did not see in the summer of 58. The illustrations weren't what he'd expected. And in the mail one day, just before Ruth's stitches were removed, was a fat envelope for Eddie from his father. It contained the names and addresses of every living Exonian in the Hamptons. In fact, it was the very same list of names and addresses that Eddie had thrown away on the ferry while crossing Long Island Sound. Someone had found the envelope with the embossed Phillips Exeter Academy return address and the senior O'Hare's carefully handwritten name, a janitor or one of the ferry crew or some meddler snooping through the trash. Whoever the idiot was, he or she had returned the list to Minty O'Hare. "You should have told me that you lost this," Eddie's father wrote to him. "I would have copied the names and addresses and given them to you again. Thankfully, someone recognized their value, a remarkable act of human kindness, and at a time in our history when acts of kindness are growing rare. Whoever it was, man or woman, didn't even ask to be repaid for the postage. It must have been the Exeter name, on the envelope, I mean. I've always said that you can never overestimate the influence of the Academy's good name."
Minty had added one name and address, he noted to Eddie. An Exonian in nearby Wainscot had somehow been omitted from the original list. It was an irritating time for Ted, too. Ruth claimed that her stitches gave her nightmares. She had most of her nightmares when it was Ted's turn to stay with her. One night the child cried and cried for her mother. Only her mommy and, to Ted's further exasperation, Eddie could comfort her. Ted had to call them in the carriage house and tell them to come home.
Then Eddie had to drive Ted back to the carriage house, where, Eddie imagined, the imprints of his and Marion's bodies were still visible, if not still warm, on the bed. When Eddie returned to the Coles' house, all the upstairs lights were on. Ruth could be soothed only by being carried from photograph to photograph. Eddie volunteered to complete the guided tour so Marion could go back to bed. But Marion seemed to be enjoying herself. In fact, Marion was aware that this would probably be her last journey through the photographic history of her dead boys with her daughter in her arms. Marion was actually prolonging the narrative that accompanied each picture. Eddie fell asleep in his room, but with the door to the guest wing hall open. For a while, he could hear Ruth and Marion's voices. Eddie knew by the child's question that they were looking at the photograph in the middle guest bedroom of Timothy crying and covered with mud. "But what happened to Timothy?" Ruth asked, although she knew the story as well as Marion knew it. By now, even Eddie knew all the stories. "Thomas pushed him in a puddle," Marion told Ruth. "How old is Timothy with the mud?" Ruth asked. "He's your age, honey," her mother said. "He was just 4." Eddie knew the next photo, too. Thomas in his hockey uniform after a game at the Exeter rink. He is standing with his arm around his mother as if she'd been cold throughout the entire game, but she also looks extremely proud to be standing there with her son's arm around her. Even though he has taken off his skates and is standing, absurdly, in full hockey uniform but with a pair of unlaced basketball shoes on his feet, Thomas is taller than Marion. What Ruth liked about the photograph is that Thomas is grinning widely, a hockey puck gripped in his teeth. Just before he fell asleep, Eddie heard Ruth ask her mother, "How old is Thomas with the thing in his mouth?" "He's Eddie's age," Eddie heard Marion say. "He was just 16. About 7 a.m., the phone rang. Marion answered it when she was still in bed. She knew by the silence that it was Mrs. Vaughn. "He's at the other house," Marion said. Then she hung up. At breakfast, Marion told Eddie, "I'll make you a bet. He breaks up with her before Ruth gets her stitches out." "But don't the stitches come out on Friday?" Eddie asked. "There were only 2 days until Friday." "I'll bet he breaks up with her today," Marion replied. "Or at least he'll try. If she's difficult about it, it may take him another couple of days." Indeed, Mrs. Vaughn would be difficult about it. Probably anticipating the difficulty, Ted tried to break up with Mrs. Vaughn by sending Eddie to do it for him. "I'm going to do what?" Eddie asked. They were standing by the biggest table in Ted's workroom, where Ted had assembled a stack of about 100 drawings of Mrs. Vaughn. Ted had some trouble closing the bulging portfolio. It was the largest portfolio he had, with his initials engraved in gold in the brown leather, TTC, Theodore Thomas Cole. "You're going to give her these, but not the portfolio. Just give her the drawings. I want the portfolio back," Ted instructed Eddie, who knew that the portfolio had been a gift from Marion. Marion had told Eddie that. "But aren't you going to see Mrs. Vaughn today?" Eddie asked him. "Isn't she expecting you?" "Tell her I'm not coming, but that I wanted her to have the drawings," Ted said. "She's going to ask me when you are coming," Eddie replied. "Tell her you don't know. Just give her the drawings. Say as little as you have to," Ted told the boy. Eddie scarcely had time to tell Marion. "He's sending you to break up with her. What a coward," Marion said, touching Eddie's hair in that motherly way she had. He was sure she was going to say something about her perpetual dissatisfaction with his haircut. Instead, she said, "Better show up early. She'll still be getting dressed. That way she'll be less tempted to invite you in. You don't want her asking you a million questions. The best thing would be to ring the bell and just hand her the drawings. You don't want to let her get you inside the house behind closed doors, believe me. Be careful she doesn't kill you." With that in mind, Eddie O'Hare arrived at the Gin Lane address early. At the entrance to the expensively pebbled driveway, he stopped by the impressive barrier of privet to remove the 100 drawings of Mrs. Vaughan from the leather portfolio. He feared it might be awkward to give Mrs. Vaughan the drawings and take back the portfolio while the small, dark woman was standing furiously in front of him. But Eddie had miscalculated the wind. As Eddie put the portfolio in the trunk of the Chevy, he transferred the drawings to the back seat of the car, where the wind blew them into a disorderly pile. He had to close the doors and windows of the Chevy in order to sort through the drawings in the back seat. He couldn't help but look at the drawings then. They began with the portraits of Mrs. Vaughan with her angry little boy. The small, tightly closed mouths of the mother and her son struck Eddie as an unkind genetic characteristic. Also, Mrs. Vaughan and her son both had intense, impatient eyes. Seated side by side, they made fists of their hands and held them rigidly on their thighs. In his mother's lap, Mrs. Vaughan's son appeared to be on the verge of clawing and kicking free of her, unless she, who also appeared to be on the verge, impulsively decided to strangle him first. There were easily 24 or more such portraits, each conveying chronic discontent and mounting tension. Then Eddie came to Mrs. Vaughan alone, at first fully dressed, but deeply alone. Eddie instantly grieved for her. If what Eddie had first spotted in Mrs. Vaughan was her furtiveness, which had given way to her submissiveness, which in turn had led her to despair, what he'd missed seeing in her was her mortal unhappiness. Ted Cole had caught this trait even before the woman began to take off her clothes. The nudes had their own sad progression. At first, the fists remained balled up on the tense thighs, and Mrs. Vaughan sat in profile, often with one or the other shoulder blocking her small breasts from view. When at last she faced the artist, her destroyer, she hugged herself to hide her breasts, and her knees were tightly pinched together. Her crotch was mostly concealed. Her pubic hair, when visible at all, was only the thinnest of lines. Then Eddie groaned in the closed car. The later nudes of Mrs. Vaughan were as unconcealed as the frankest photographs of a cadaver. Her arms hung loosely at her sides, as if her shoulders had been savagely dislocated in a violent fall. Her exposed and unsupported breasts drooped. The nipple of one breast seemed larger and darker and more down-pointed than the other. Her knees were spread apart, as if she'd lost all sensation in her legs, or else she'd broken her pelvis. For such a small woman, her navel was too large, her pubic hair too abundant. Her vagina was gaping and slack. The very last of the nudes was the first pornography that Eddie O'Hare had ever seen. Not that Eddie fully understood what was pornographic about the drawings. Eddie felt sick and deeply sorry that he'd seen the drawings, which had reduced Mrs. Vaughan to the hole in her center. The nudes managed to make even less of Mrs. Vaughan than what had remained of her strong smell on the rental house pillows. Under the tires of the Chevy, the crunching of the perfect stones in the driveway leading to the Vaughan mansion sounded like the breaking bones of small animals. As Eddie passed a squirting fountain in the circular driveway, he saw the movement of an upstairs curtain. When he rang the doorbell, he nearly dropped the drawings, which he was able to hold only by hugging them with both his arms against his chest. He waited forever for the small, dark woman to appear. Marion had been right. Mrs. Vaughan had not finished getting dressed, or possibly she'd not completed the exact phase of undress that she might have been preparing, to look alluring to Ted. Her hair was wet and lank, and her upper lip looked rubbed raw at one corner of her mouth, like a clown's unfinished smile, remained a trace of the hair removal ointment that she'd too hastily tried to wipe away.
Mrs. Vaughan had been hasty in her choice of a robe as well, for she stood in the doorway in a white terry cloth thing that resembled a giant, ungainly towel. It was probably her husband's robe, for it hung over her thin ankles, one edge dragged on the door sill. She was barefoot. The wet nail polish on the nail of her big right toe had been smeared across the top of her right foot in such a way that it looked as if she'd cut her foot and was bleeding. "What do you want?" Mrs. Vaughan asked. Then she looked past Eddie at Ted's car. Before Eddie could answer, she asked him, "Where is he? Isn't he coming? What's wrong?" "He couldn't make it," Eddie informed her, "but he wanted you to have these." In the wild wind, he didn't dare hold out the drawings to her. Awkwardly, he still hugged them to his chest. "He couldn't make it?" she repeated. "What does that mean?" "I don't know," Eddie lied. "But there are all these drawings. May I put them down somewhere?" he begged. "What drawings?" "Oh, the drawings." "Oh," said Mrs. Vaughan, as if someone had struck her in the stomach. She stepped back, tripping on the long white robe. She nearly fell. Eddie followed her inside, feeling like her executioner. The polished marble floor reflected the overhanging chandelier. In the distance, through an open pair of double doors, a second chandelier hung above a dining room table. The house looked like an art museum. The far-off dining room was as big as a banquet hall. Eddie walked, for what seemed to him to be a mile or so, to the table and put the drawings down, not realizing until he turned to go that Mrs. Vaughan had followed as closely and silently behind him as his shadow. When she saw the topmost drawing, one of her with her son, she gasped. "He's giving them to me," she cried. "He doesn't want them?" "I don't know," Eddie said miserably. Mrs. Vaughan rapidly leafed through the drawings until she got to the first nude. Then she overturned the stack, taking the last drawing off the bottom, which was now the top. Eddie turned away. He knew what the last drawing was. "Oh," Mrs. Vaughan said, as if she'd been punched again. "But when is he coming?" she called after Eddie. "He's coming Friday, isn't he? I have the whole day to see him Friday. He knows I have the whole day. He knows!" Eddie tried to keep walking. He heard her bare feet on the marble floor. She was scampering after him. She caught up to him under the big chandelier. "Stop," she shouted. "Is he coming Friday?" "I don't know," Eddie repeated, backing out the door. The wind tried to keep him inside. "Yes, you do know," Mrs. Vaughan screamed. "Tell me." She followed him outside, but the wind almost knocked her down. Her robe blew open. She struggled to close it. Eddie would always retain this vision of her, as if to remind him of what the worst kind of nakedness was. The utterly unwanted glimpse of Mrs. Vaughan's slack breasts and her dark triangle of matted pubic hair. "Stop!" she cried again, but the sharp stones in the driveway prevented her from following him to the car. She bent down and picked up a handful of the pebbles, which she threw at Eddie. Most of them struck the Chevy. "Did he show you those drawings? Did you look at them? God damn you, you looked at them, didn't you?" she cried. "No," Eddie lied. As Mrs. Vaughan bent down to pick up another handful of stones, a gust of wind blew her off balance. Like a gunshot, the open front door slammed shut behind her. "My God, I'm locked out," she said to Eddie. "Isn't there another door that's unlocked?" he asked. The mansion must have had a dozen doors. "I thought Ted was coming. He likes all the doors to be locked," said Mrs. Vaughan. "You don't hide a key somewhere for emergencies?" Eddie asked. "I sent the gardener home. Ted doesn't like the gardener to be around," said Mrs. Vaughan. "The gardener has an emergency key." "Can't you call the gardener?" "On what phone?" shouted Mrs. Vaughan. "You'll have to break in." "Me?" the 16-year-old said. "Well, you know how to do it, don't you?" the small dark woman asked. "I don't know how to do it," she wailed. There were no open windows because of the air conditioning. The Vaughans had air conditioning because of their art collection, which was also why there were no open windows. By a garden in the back, there were French doors, but Mrs. Vaughan warned Eddie that the glass was of a special thickness and laced with chicken wire, which made it nearly impenetrable. By swinging a rock, which he tied up in his T-shirt, Eddie was finally able to smash the glass, but he still needed to find one of the gardener's tools in order to rip the chicken wire sufficiently for his hand to fit through the hole and unlock the door from the inside. The rock, which was a centerpiece to the bird bath in the garden, had dirtied Eddie's T-shirt, which had also been cut by the breaking glass. He decided to leave his shirt and the rock in the smashed glass by the now open door. But Mrs. Vaughn, who was barefoot, insisted that he carry her into the house through the French doors. She didn't want to risk cutting her feet on the broken glass. Bare-chested, Eddie carried her into her house, being careful, as he reached around her, not to get his hands on the wrong side of her robe. She weighed next to nothing, barely more than Ruth. But when he held her in his arms, even so briefly, her strong smell came close to overpowering him. Her scent was indescribable, and he couldn't say what she smelled like, only that the scent made him gag. When he put her down, she sensed his unconcealed revulsion. "You look as if you're disgusted," she told him. "How dare you? How dare you detest me?" Eddie was standing in a room he'd never been in before. He didn't know his way to the big chandelier at the main entrance, and when he turned to look for the French doors to the garden, a maze of open doorways confronted him. He also didn't know how to find the door he'd just come in. "How do I get out?" he asked Mrs. Vaughn. "How dare you detest me?" she repeated. "You're not exactly living an unsordid life yourself, are you?" Mrs. Vaughn asked the boy.
"Please, I want to go home," Eddie told her.
It wasn't until he spoke that he realized he really meant it and that he meant Exeter, New Hampshire, not Sagaponack. Eddie meant that he really wanted to go home. It was a weakness he would carry with him for the rest of his life. He would always be inclined to cry in front of older women, as he'd once cried in front of Marion, as he now commenced to cry in front of Mrs. Vaughn.
Without another word, she took him by his wrist and led him through the museum of her house to the chandelier at the front door. The touch of her small, cold hand was like a bird's foot, as if a diminutive parrot or a parakeet had grabbed hold of him. When she opened the door and pushed him into the wind, a number of doors slammed in the interior of her house, and as he turned to say goodbye, he saw the sudden whirlwind of Ted's terrible drawings. The wind had blown them off the dining room table. Eddie couldn't speak, nor could Mrs. Vaughn. When she heard the drawings fluttering behind her, she wheeled around in her big white robe, as if preparing herself for an attack. Indeed, before the front door again slammed shut in the wind, like a second gunshot, Mrs. Vaughn was about to be attacked. Surely she would recognize in those drawings at least a measure of the degree to which she'd allowed herself to be assaulted.
"She threw rocks at you?" Marion asked Eddie. "They were little stones. Most of them hit the car," Eddie admitted.
"She made you carry her?" Marion asked.
"She was barefoot," Eddie explained again. "There was all this broken glass."
"And you left your shirt?"
"Why?"
"It was ruined. It was just a T-shirt."
As for Ted, his conversation with Eddie was a little different.
"What did she mean, she has the whole day Friday?" Ted asked. "Does she expect me to spend the whole day with her?"
"I don't know,"
the 16-year-old said.
"Why did she think you'd looked at the drawings?" Ted asked. "Did you? Did you look at them?"
"No," Eddie lied.
"Christ, of course you did," Ted said.
"She exposed herself to me," Eddie told him.
"Jesus, she did what?"
"She didn't mean to," Eddie admitted. "But she exposed herself. It was the wind. It blew her robe open."
"Jesus Christ," Ted said.
"She locked herself out of her house because of you," Eddie told him. "She said you wanted all the doors locked and that you didn't like the gardener to be around."
"She told you that?"
"I had to break into her house. I smashed in the French doors with a part of the bird bath.
I had a carrier through the broken glass, Eddie complained. I lost my shirt.
Who cares about your shirt? Ted shouted.
I can't spend the whole day with her Friday. I'll have you drop me off there the first thing Friday morning, but you must come back to get me in 45 minutes. Forget that. In half an hour. I couldn't possibly spend 45 minutes with that crazy woman.
You just have to trust me, Eddie, Marion told him. I'm going to tell you what we're going to do.
Okay, Eddie said. He couldn't stop thinking about the worst of the drawings. He wanted to tell Marion about Mrs. Vaughan's smell, but he couldn't describe it.
On Friday morning, you're going to leave him at Mrs. Vaughan's, Marion began.
I know, the boy said, for half an hour.
No, not for half an hour, Marion informed the 16-year-old. You're going to leave him with her and not come back to pick him up. It will take him most of the day to get home by himself without a car. I'll bet you anything that Mrs. Vaughan won't offer to drive him.
But what will he do? Eddie asked.
You mustn't be afraid of Ted, Marion reminded him.
What will he do?
It will probably occur to him that the only person he knows in Southampton is Dr. Leonardis.
Dave Leonardis was one of Ted's regular squash opponents.
It will take Ted half an hour or 45 minutes just to walk to Dr. Leonardis' office, Marion continued.
And then, what will he do?
He'll have to wait all day until all of Leonardis's patients have gone home before he can get a ride home with the doctor, unless one of Leonardis's patients is someone Ted knows or someone who happens to be driving in the direction of Sagaponack.
Ted's going to be furious, Eddie warned her.
You just have to trust me, Eddie.
Okay, the boy told her.
After you drive Ted to Mrs. Vaughan's, you're going to come back here and get Ruth, Marion went on. Then you're going to take Ruth to her doctor to get her stitches out. Then I want you to take Ruth to the beach. Let her get wet. Let her celebrate having her stitches out.
Excuse me, Eddie interrupted. Why doesn't one of the nannies take Ruth to the beach?
There will be no nannies on Friday, Marion informed him. I need the day, or as much of the day as you can give me, to be alone here.
But what are you going to do? Eddie asked.
I'm going to tell you exactly, she told him again. You just have to trust me completely.
Okay, he said.
But for the first time, Eddie knew that he didn't trust Marion, not completely. After all, he was her pawn. He'd already had the sort of day that a pawn might have.
I looked at the drawings of Mrs. Vaughan, he confessed to Marion.
Merciful heavens, she said to him. He didn't want to cry again, but he allowed her to pull his face into her breasts. He let her hold him there while he struggled to say what he felt.
In the drawings, she was somehow more than naked, he began.
I know, Marion whispered to him. She kissed the top of his head.
It was not just that she was naked, Eddie insisted. It was as if you could see everything that she must have submitted to. She looked like she'd been tortured or something.
I know, Marion said again. I'm so sorry.
Also, the wind blew her robe open and I saw her, Eddie blurted out. She was exposed only for a second, but it was as if I already knew everything about her.
Then he realized what it was about Mrs. Vaughan's smell.
And when I had to pick her up and carry her, Eddie said, I noticed her smell, like on the pillows, only stronger. It made me gag.
What did she smell like? Marion asked him.
Like something dead, Eddie told her.
Poor Mrs. Vaughan, Marion said.
Why panic at 10 o'clock in the morning? It was shortly before 8 on Friday morning when Eddie picked Ted up at the carriage house for the drive to Southampton and what Ted thought would be a half-hour meeting with Mrs. Vaughan. Eddie's nervousness was extreme, and not only because he feared that Ted would have Mrs. Vaughn on his hands a lot longer than he presumed. Marion had more or less scripted Eddie's day. Eddie had a lot to remember. When he and Ted stopped for coffee at the Sagoponic General Store, Eddie knew all about the moving truck that was parked there. The two sturdy movers were drinking coffee and reading their morning newspapers in the cab. When Eddie had returned from Mrs. Vaughn's to take Ruth to her doctor's appointment to have her stitches removed, Marion would know where she could find the movers. The movers, like Eddie, had been given their instructions, to wait at the store until Marion came to get them. Ted and Ruth and the nannies, who'd been dismissed for the day, would never see the movers. By the time Ted found his way home from Southampton, the movers and everything Marion wanted to take with her would be gone. Marion herself would be gone. She had forewarned Eddie of this. That would leave Eddie to explain it all to Ted. That was the script Eddie kept rehearsing on the way to Southampton. "But who's going to explain it all to Ruth?" Eddie had asked. There then crept into Marion's expression that same aura of distance that Eddie had witnessed when he'd asked her about the accident. Clearly, Marion had not scripted the part of the story where someone explains it all to Ruth. "When Ted asks you where I've gone, just say you don't know," Marion told Eddie. "But where are you going?" Eddie asked. "You don't know," Marion repeated. "If Ted insists on a better answer to anything, just say that he'll be hearing from my lawyer. My lawyer will tell him everything." "Oh, great," Eddie said. "And if he hits you, just hit him back. By the way, he won't make a fist. At worst, he'll slap you. But you should use your fist," Marion advised Eddie. "Just punch him in the nose. If you punch him in the nose, he'll stop." "But what about Ruth?" The plans for Ruth were vague. If Ted began to shout, how much should Ruth hear? If there were a fight, how much should the child see? If the nannies had been dismissed, Ruth would have to be either with Ted or with Eddie or with them both. Why wouldn't she be upset? "You can call Alice if you need help with Ruth," Marion had suggested to Eddie. "I told Alice that you or Ted might call her. In fact, I told her to call the house about mid-afternoon, to see if you needed her after all." Alice was the afternoon nanny, the pretty college girl with her own car. She was the nanny Eddie liked the least, Eddie had reminded Marion. "You better get to like her a little," Marion replied. "If Ted kicks you out, and I can't imagine that he'll want you to stay, you're going to need a ride to the ferry at Orient Point. Ted's not permitted to drive, you know. Not that he would want to drive you anyway." "Ted's going to kick me out, and I'm going to have to ask Alice for a ride," Eddie echoed. Marion merely kissed him. And then the moment was at hand. When Eddie stopped at Mrs. Vaughn's concealed driveway on Gin Lane, Ted said, "You better wait here for me. I'm not going to last a half hour with that woman. Maybe 20 minutes tops, maybe 10. "I'll go and come back," Eddie lied. "Be back in 15 minutes, Ted told him. Then he noticed the long scraps of his familiar drawing paper. The tatters of his drawings were blowing in the wind. His drawings had been ripped to shreds. The forbidding barrier of privet had kept most of the torn paper from blowing into the street, but the hedges were bedecked with waving flags and strips of paper as if some unruly wedding guests had strewn the Vaughn estate with makeshift confetti. As Ted walked up the noisy driveway at a slow, stricken pace, Eddie got out of the car to watch. He even followed Ted a short distance. The courtyard was littered with the remains of Ted's drawings. The spitting fountain was clogged with wet wads of paper. The water had turned a sepia shade of grayish-brown. "The squid ink," Ted said aloud. "Make that 10 minutes, he added over his shoulder. Eddie, walking backwards, was already retreating to the car. He had spotted the gardener on a ladder plucking paper from the privet.
The gardener had scowled at both Eddie and Ted, but Ted had noticed neither the gardener nor the ladder. The squid ink staining the water in the fountain had entirely captured Ted's attention. "Oh, boy," he muttered as Eddie left him. Compared to Ted, the gardener was better dressed. There was always something careless and rumpled about Ted's clothes, jeans, a tucked-in T-shirt, and, on this somewhat cool Friday morning, an unbuttoned flannel shirt that was flapping in the wind. And this morning Ted was unshaven, too. He was doing his best to make the worst possible impression on Mrs. Vaughn. Ted and his drawings had already made the worst possible impression on Mrs. Vaughn's gardener. Five minutes, Ted called to Eddie. Given the long day ahead, it hardly mattered that Eddie didn't hear him. Back in Sagaponack, Marion had packed a large beach bag for Ruth, who was already wearing her bathing suit under her shorts and T-shirt. In the bag were towels and two changes of clothes, including long pants and a sweatshirt. "You can take her anywhere you like for lunch," Marion told Eddie. "All she ever eats is a grilled cheese sandwich with French fries." "And ketchup," Ruth said. Marion tried to give Eddie a $10 bill for lunch. "I have money," Eddie told her, but when he turned his back on her to help Ruth into the Chevy, Marion stuck the $10 bill into the right rear pocket of his jeans. And he remembered what it had felt like the first time she'd pulled him to her by tugging the waist of his jeans, her knuckles against his bare stomach. Then she'd unsnapped his jeans and unzipped his fly, which he would remember for about 5 or 10 years, every time he undressed himself. "Remember, honey," Marion said to Ruth, "don't cry when the doctor takes out your stitches. I promise it's not going to hurt." "Can I keep the stitches?" the 4-year-old asked. "I suppose," Marion replied. "Sure you can keep them," Eddie told the child. "So long, Eddie," Marion said. She was wearing tennis shorts and tennis shoes, although she didn't play tennis, and a floppy flannel shirt that was too big for her. It was Ted's. She wasn't wearing a bra. Earlier that morning, when Eddie was leaving to pick up Ted at the carriage house, Marion had taken his hand and put it under her shirt and held it against her bare breast. "Thank you, Eddie," she whispered to the boy, but when he tried to kiss her, she left him standing in the upstairs hall, with all the photographs, because Ruth had called for her. "Coming, honey," her mother had said, leaving Eddie's right hand with the feel of her bare breast, which he would go on feeling for about 10 or 15 years. "Tell me all about the stitches," Ruth said to Eddie as he made a left turn. "You won't really feel them very much when the doctor takes them out," Eddie said. "Why not?" the child asked him. Before he made the next turn, a right, he had his last sight of Marion and the Mercedes in the rearview mirror. She would not be turning right, Eddie knew. The movers were waiting straight ahead of her. The left side of Marion's face was illuminated by the morning sun, which brightly shone through the driver's side window of the Mercedes. The window was open, and Eddie could see the wind blowing Marion's hair. Just before he turned, Marion waved to him and to her daughter, as if she were still intending to be there when Eddie and Ruth returned. "Why won't it hurt to take the stitches out?" Ruth asked Eddie again. "Because the cut has healed. The skin has grown back together," Eddie told her. Marion was now gone from view. "Is that it?" he was wondering. "So long, Eddie." Were those her last words to him? "I suppose," were Marion's last words to her daughter. Eddie couldn't believe the abruptness of it. The open window of the Mercedes, Marion's hair blowing in the wind, Marion's arm waving out the window. And only half of Marion's face was in the sunlight. The rest of her was invisible. Eddie O'Hare couldn't have known that neither he nor Ruth would see Marion again. Not for 37 years. But for all those years, Eddie would wonder at the seeming nonchalance of her departure. How could she? Eddie would think. As one day, Ruth would also think about her mother. The two stitches were removed so quickly that Ruth didn't have time to cry. The 4-year-old was more interested in the stitches themselves than in her almost perfect scar. The thin white line was discolored only slightly by traces of iodine, or whatever the antiseptic was. It had left a yellow-brown stain. Now that she could get her finger wet again, the doctor told her, this stain would be removed by her first good bath. But it was of greater concern to Ruth that the two stitches, which had each been cut in two, were saved in an envelope, and that the crusted scab near the knotted end of one of the 4 pieces not be damaged. "I want to show my stitches to Mommy," Ruth said, "and my scab." "First, let's go to the beach," Eddie suggested. "Let's show her the scab first, then the stitches," Ruth replied. "We'll see," Eddie began. He paused to consider that the doctor's office in Southampton was not more than a 15-minute walk from Mrs. Vaughan's mansion on Gin Lane. It was now 9:45 in the morning. If Ted was still there, he would already have been with Mrs. Vaughan for more than an hour. More likely, Ted was not with Mrs. Vaughan, but Ted might have remembered that Ruth was having her stitches removed this morning, and he might know where the doctor's office was. "Let's go to the beach," Eddie said to Ruth. "Let's hurry." "First the scab, then the stitches, then the beach," the child replied. "Let's talk about it in the car," Eddie suggested. But there is no straightforward negotiation with a 4-year-old. While not every negotiation needs to be difficult, there are few that don't require a considerable investment of time. "Did we forget the picture?" Ruth asked Eddie. "The picture?" Eddie said. "What picture?" "The feet," Ruth cried. "Oh, the photograph. It's not ready," Eddie told her. "That's not very nice," the child declared. "My stitches are ready. My cut is all fixed up." "Yes," Eddie agreed. He thought he saw a way to distract the 4-year-old from her desire to show her scab and stitches to her mother before going to the beach. "Let's go to the frame shop and tell them to give us the picture," Eddie suggested. "All fixed up," Ruth added. "Good idea," Eddie proclaimed. He was looking all around for Ted. Ted would never think of going to the frame shop, Eddie decided. Eddie thought that the frame shop was almost as safe as the beach. "First, make a fuss about the photograph," he was thinking. "Then Ruth won't remember about showing her scab and stitches to Marion." When the child was watching a dog scratching itself in the parking lot, Eddie put the envelope with the precious scab and stitches into the glove compartment. But the frame shop was a little less safe than Eddie supposed. Ted had not remembered that Ruth was having her stitches removed this morning. Mrs. Vaughan hadn't given Ted the time to remember very much. Less than 5 minutes after his arrival at her door, Ted was chased into the courtyard and up Gin Lane by Mrs. Vaughan, who was brandishing a serrated bread knife while shrieking at him that he was the epitome of diabolism. He vaguely recalled that this was the title of a dreadful painting in the Vaughan's regrettable art collection. The gardener, who had watched the artist, as he witheringly thought of Ted, make his trepid approach to the Vaughan mansion, was also the witness of Ted's intrepid retreat across the courtyard, where the artist was nearly driven into the murky fountain by the relentless slashes and stabs that Mrs. Vaughan made in the nearby air with her knife. Ted had bolted out the driveway and into the street with his former model in passionate pursuit. The gardener, terrified that one or the other of them might run headlong into his ladder, which was a 15-footer, clung precariously to the top of the high privet hedge. From that height, the gardener was able to observe that Ted Cole could and did outrun Mrs. Vaughan, who gave up the chase a few driveways short of the intersection of Gin Lane and Wyandanch. There was another high barrier of privet near the intersection, and from the gardener's elevated but distant perspective, Either Ted had disappeared into the hedges, or he had turned northward onto Wyandanch Lane without once looking back. Mrs. Vaughan, still in a fury, and still decrying the artist as the epitome of diabolism, returned to her own driveway. Spontaneously, to the gardener it seemed involuntarily, she still slashed and stabbed the air with a serrated knife. A period of intense quiet fell over the Vaughan estate and descended on Gin Lane. Ted, tangled deep in a dense mass of privet, could hardly move enough to see his watch. The privet was a maze of such density not even a Jack Russell Terrier could have penetrated the hedge, which had scratched Ted's hands and face and left him bleeding. Still, he had escaped the bread knife and, for the moment, Mrs. Vaughan. But where was Eddie? Ted waited in the privet for his familiar 57 Chevy to appear. The gardener, who had begun his chore of retrieving the shredded drawings of his employer and her son a full hour or more before Ted made his appearance, had long ago stopped looking at what he could see of the remains of the drawings. Even piecemeal, the content of the drawings was too disturbing. The gardener already knew his employer's eyes and her small mouth and the rest of her strained face. He already knew her hands and the unnatural tension in her shoulders. Worse, the gardener had vastly preferred to imagine Mrs. Vaughan's breasts and her vagina. The reality of what he had seen of her nakedness in the ruined drawings was uninviting. Moreover, he had been working at a great pace, for although he well understood why Mrs. Vaughan would have wanted to dispose of the drawings, he could not conceive of what insanity had possessed her to rip up the pornographic exposure of herself in a windstorm with all the doors open. On the ocean side of the house, the scraps and shreds had stuck in the barrier of beech roses, but some partial views of Mrs. Vaughan and her son had found their way along the footpath and were now blowing up and down the beach. The gardener did not especially like Mrs. Vaughan's son. He was a haughty boy who'd once peed in the birdbath, and then denied it. But the gardener had been a faithful employee of the Vaughan family since before the brat's birth, and he felt some additional responsibility to the neighborhood. The gardener could think of no one who would enjoy even these partial views of Mrs. Vaughan's private parts. Yet the pace at which he worked to clean up the mess was arrested by his fascination with what had become of the artist. Namely, was the artist hiding in a neighbor's hedge, or had he escaped toward town? At 9:30 in the morning, when Eddie O'Hare was already an hour late, Ted Cole crawled out of the privet on Gin Lane and cautiously walked past the driveway of the Vaughan estate, to give Eddie every opportunity to see him, should Eddie, for some reason, have been waiting for Ted at the west end of Gin Lane, which intersected South Main Street. In the gardener's opinion, this was an unwise, even a reckless move. From the third-floor turret of the Vaughan mansion, Mrs. Vaughan could see over the privet. If the wronged woman was in the turret, she would have a commanding view of all of Gin Lane. Indeed, Mrs. Vaughan must have had such a view, for not seconds after Ted had passed her driveway and was now quickening his pace along Gin Lane, the gardener was alarmed to hear the roar of Mrs. Vaughan's car. It was a glistening black Lincoln, and it shot out of the garage at such speed that it slid on the stones in the courtyard and nearly crashed into the darkened fountain. In a last-second effort to miss the fountain, Mrs. Vaughan veered too near the privet. The Lincoln clipped the bottom of the gardener's ladder, leaving the distraught man clinging to the top of the high hedge. "Run!" the gardener called to Ted. That Ted would live to see another day must be credited to the regular and rigorous exercise he gained on the squash court that was designed to give him an unfair advantage. Even at 45, Ted Cole could run. He cleared some rose bushes without breaking stride and raced across a lawn in full view of a gawking but silent man who was vacuuming a swimming pool. Ted was then chased by a dog, fortunately a small and cowardly dog, By grabbing a woman's bathing suit off a clothesline and lashing the dog in the face with it, Ted drove the craven animal away. Naturally, Ted was hollered at by several gardeners and maids and housewives. Undeterred, he climbed three fences and scaled one fairly high stone wall. He felt fastest on lawns. He trampled only two flower beds. And he never saw Mrs. Vaughn's Lincoln cut the corner of Gin Lane onto South Main Street, where she flattened a road sign in the eagerness of her pursuit. However, through the slats of a wooden fence on Toilsome Lane, Ted saw the black-as-a-hearse Lincoln rush parallel to him as he traversed two lawns, a yard full of fruit trees, and something resembling a Japanese garden where he stepped in a shallow pool of goldfish, soaking his shoes and his jeans to his knees. Ted doubled back on Toilsome. Daring to cross that street, he saw the flicker of the black Lincoln's brake lights and feared that Mrs. Vaughn had spotted him in her rear-view mirror and was stopping to double back on Toilsome herself. But she hadn't spotted him. He'd lost her. Ted entered the town of Southampton, looking much the worse for wear, but walking boldly into the heart of the shops and the stores on South Main Street. If he hadn't been so energetically on the lookout for the black Lincoln, he might have seen his own 57 Chevy, which was parked by the frame shop on South Main. But Ted walked right past his car without recognizing it and entered a bookstore diagonally across the street. They knew him in the bookstore. They knew Ted Cole in every bookstore, of course, but Ted made periodic visits to this particular bookstore where he routinely autographed however many copies of his backlist titles were in stock. The bookseller and his attendant staff were not used to seeing Mr. Cole look quite as bedraggled as he appeared before them on this Friday morning, but they had known him to be unshaven, and he was often dressed more in the manner of a college student or a working man than in whatever fashion was customary among best-selling authors and illustrators of children's books. It was chiefly the blood that lent a novelty to Ted's appearance. His scratched and bleeding face and the dirtier blood on the backs of his hands, where he had clawed his way into and out of a 100-year-old hedge, indicated mishap or mayhem to the surprised bookseller, whose name, inexplicably, was Mendelssohn. He was no relation to the German composer, and this Mendelssohn either overliked his last name or disliked his first so much that he never revealed it. When Ted had once asked him his first name, Mendelssohn had said only, "Not Felix." On this Friday, whether it was the sight of Ted's blood that excited him, or the fact that Ted's jeans were dripping on the floor of the bookstore, Ted's shoes actually squirted water in several directions whenever Ted took a step, Mendelssohn grabbed Ted by the dirty tails of his untucked and unbuttoned flannel shirt and exclaimed in a too loud voice, "Ted Cole!" "Yes, it is Ted Cole," Ted admitted. "Good morning, Mendelssohn." "It's Ted Cole, it is," Mendelssohn repeated. "I'm sorry I'm bleeding," Ted told him calmly. "Oh, don't be silly, it's nothing to be sorry about," Mendelssohn shouted. Then he turned to a dumbstruck young woman on his staff. She was standing nearby, with a look of both awe and horror. Mendelssohn commanded her to bring Mr. Cole a chair. "Can't you see he's bleeding?" Mendelssohn said to her. But Ted asked if he could use the washroom first. He'd just been in an accident, he solemnly said. Then he shut himself in a small bathroom with a sink and toilet. He assessed the damage in the mirror while composing, as only a writer can, a story of surpassing simplicity regarding what sort of accident he'd just had. He saw that a branch of the evil hedge had lashed one eye and left it weepy. A deeper scratch was the source of the bleeding from his forehead. A scrape that bled less but looked harder to heal stood out on one cheek. He washed his hands. The cuts stung, but the bleeding from the backs of his hands had largely stopped. He removed his flannel shirt and tied the muddy sleeves, one had also been dipped in the goldfish pool, around his waist. Ted took this moment to admire his waist. At 45, he was still a man who could wear a pair of jeans and tuck in his T-shirt and be proud of the overall effect. However, the T-shirt was white, and its appearance was not improved by the pronounced grass stains on the left shoulder and the right breast. Ted had fallen on at least two lawns. And his jeans, which were soaked below the knees, continued to drip into his water-filled shoes. As composed as he could be under the circumstances, Ted emerged from the bathroom and was once more effusively greeted by last-name-only Mendelssohn, who'd already prepared a chair for the visiting author. The chair was drawn up to a table where a few dozen copies of Ted Cole's books were waiting to be signed. But first, Ted wanted to make a phone call, actually two. He tried the carriage house to find out if Eddie was there. There was no answer. And, of course, there was no answer at Ted's own house. Marion knew better than to answer the phone on this well-rehearsed Friday. Had Eddie crashed the car? The 16-year-old had been driving erratically earlier that morning. Doubtless Marion had fucked the boy's brains out, Ted concluded.